I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yossi Klein Halevi says he's like most Israelis who want to be doves but feel compelled by reality to be hawks. That's a quote from a recent article. Halevi is an American-born writer and journalist who has lived in Israel for three decades. He's the author of three books, including a new one. It's called Like Dreamers, the story of the Israeli paratroopers who reunited Jerusalem and divided a nation. It's about seven soldiers who came together in a brigade to fight in the 1967 war and went on to live very different lives. One was a founder of the settlement movement. Another was part of an anti-Zionist group in Syria and spent years in an Israeli prison. Yossi Klein Halevi says these stories reveal much about the challenges, the vibrancy, and the diversity of modern-day Israel. Yossi Klein Halevi is a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, a contributing editor to the New Republic, and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. It's been about a decade or so. Nice to have you back on the show.
Nice to be with you, Marty. Thank you.
Let me begin with these soldiers, and actually the cover picture on your book of some very exhausted soldiers. What does this story mean to Israelis?
Well, 1967 is the watershed moment in Israeli history. There's Israel pre-1967 and Israel post. Most immediately, 1967 meant a reprieve from the threat of destruction. And Israeli society went from existential dread in those first days before the war to enormous relief when we realized that we'd won the war, to euphoria when we realized the extent of the victory, and then post-euphoria schism as we began to realize we have a problem here and we need to figure out what to do with the spoils of victory, which were the territories.
And I do want to talk about all of that, but just to mark in 1967, that was just 20 years after the end of World War II.
That's right. That's right. And so the period before in the weeks before the Six-Day War, when Arab armies were converging on Israel's borders and Arab leaders were threatening to drive the Jews into the sea, reawakened all of those still very alive traumas. And that period of time has been eclipsed by the Israeli victory. But in the Israeli consciousness, the existential threat before the war remains very much a part of the period of 67.
And how old were you in 1967?
Well, I was 14. And a Brooklyn boy watching the news from the Middle East on TV with my father, who was a Holocaust survivor. And so for him, this threat, the threat to Israel's existence, was as raw and intense as it could be. And he conveyed that to me. So I was living vicariously through his fears. And as soon as the war ended, he said, "We're going to Israel."
Huh.
And it was a very common response among American Jews at the time. There was this sense of, first of all, we suddenly realized how much Israel meant to us. The fact that Israel was in danger and then had saved itself, we American Jews felt we had to be there. We wanted to touch Israel. And that, for me, was the transformative summer of my life. It was being in Israel in the summer of 67. It was as if we were experiencing the happy ending of Jewish history, or so we thought.
Or so you thought. These seven paratroopers, and each has a very a unique story to tell. And even in 1967, they were not cut out of the same cloth at all. These were people
right.
with very different backgrounds and ideas.
Yeah. I chose two groups. Look, there were 2,000 paratroopers who fought in the Battle of Jerusalem, and it took me 2 years to just figure out who I want to interview. This book took 11 years to write. And once I realized the camps that I was interested in focusing on, the story began to tell itself. The two groups comes from the community known as religious Zionists, who saw in the creation of the State of Israel, especially after the Holocaust, as a messianic event, and not necessarily metaphorically, in many cases literally. And the other group were radical secular left-wingers, members of the kibbutz movement. The kibbutz was the socialist agrarian commune that really founded the state of Israel. And it's interesting that today one has to explain what a kibbutz is because...
They don't exist?
Well, they do exist, but they've mostly become privatized. And but 30 or 40 years ago, when I first encountered Israel, Israel was kibbutz. The image of Israel in the world, very different than today, was the socialist communes. And so the book tells the story of these two groups, the religious Zionists, who then went on after the Six-Day War to become the leaders and the founders of the West Bank settlement movement. Many of these kibbutzniks, as they were called, went on to become leaders of the Israeli peace movement. Right. And so and yet they were friends. They served together. So it's a band of
brothers?
Of dysfunctional brothers.
But continued to meet over the years.
Over the years. And the book becomes the entwined stories of these seven men, and it tells the story of Israel's increasingly bitter left-right schism through the 70s, 80s, and 90s through these entwined stories.
Well, and perhaps one of the most surprising is a man named Udi Aviv.
Adiv.
Yes. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Udi Adiv was a kibbutznik, a paratrooper, fought in Jerusalem, and after the Six-Day War, he turned so far left that he joined a minuscule anti-Zionist Israeli group. And then went on to Syria, illegally, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Under an assumed name. Right. And tried to start a joint Arab-Jewish terrorist group against Israel. He was arrested on his return and spent 12 years in an Israeli prison. This was an enormously famous Israeli scandal at the time. And so the book really lays out... It's a generational story. These are the Israelis who were born with the state. You remember Salman Rushdie's book, Midnight's Children?
Indeed.
So that book made an enormous impression on me when I read it years ago. And I felt there needs to be some way to tell the story of Israel's first generation. And so the parameters here really are from left to right, even far left and far right, and all the points in the middle.
But what's interesting about Adiv is that going to Syria, he sees a Jewish quarter there and comes to the conclusion that Jews don't need a state to survive, or Jews don't need a country in order to be safe.
Yes, and that he sees Syria. Now, Syria.
Syria, exactly. Think Syria, right.
And he sees Syria as this benign model for how Jews could survive in the Middle East without power. And he says, we don't need power. We don't need an army. Look how happy the Jews are in Syria. Now, that's one of the few moments in the book where I couldn't restrain myself as an author and had to insert a sarcastic comment. What I've tried to do generally as a writer is let these characters speak for themselves.
But how did the settlement movement then grow out of this war and probably grow out of the 1973, the Yom Kippur War as
yes,
well?
It's interesting. More directly from the 1973 war. After the 1967 war, the labor governments at the time, and labor was, I mean, Israel was, for all practical purposes, a one-party system that was governed by the Labor Party, by the Israeli left, until 1977 when the Likud came to power. We had 50 parties, but we were a one-party system. And the settlement movement was restrained after the Six-Day War by the labor governments. From my point of view, wisely, the labor governments did not allow the settlement movement to spread. Once the Yom Kippur War happens and the labor government loses its prestige, its standing among Israelis, because we nearly lost the Yom Kippur War in those first days.
Unprepared, essentially, for this attack.
Exactly. Israel was attacked on two fronts by the Syrian and Egyptian armies on Yom Kippur Day, the one day of the year when Israel is least prepared for war. And the anger and outrage within Israel was so profound that period gave birth both to the peace movement and to the settlement movement as organized forces. So that contemporary Israel As we know it today, it was really born not after 1967, mm-hmm. but after 1973.
And the settlement movement was the message was that we are not safe in this part of the world, and we need to occupy these lands.
Exactly, exactly. What happened was that left-wing and right-wing Israelis drew opposite conclusions from the Yom Kippur War. The conclusion of the left was that we need to pursue a more aggressive peace policy and not only rely on military mm-hmm. strength, because one of these days you may find yourself in a situation where your military strength gives out. The conclusion of the right was we were nearly wiped out. The state was nearly destroyed, and we need to ensure that we don't go back to those narrow pre-1967 borders, which were mm-hmm. 9 miles wide at Israel's narrowest point. And so the schism that emerges in Israel, and which really defined modern Israel, is born out of these two responses to the trauma of 1973.
And these seven paratroopers, as you write about it, embody, I guess, this split.
This is exactly,
I mean, here
right.
they are fighting together.
That's right.
I mean, there's compulsory military service, but yes. nonetheless fighting together.
Well, they fight together in war after war. Some of these men fought together in 3 and 4 wars. And in the intervals between wars, they're fighting each other to determine the mm-hmm. nature of Israeli society.
And does that surprise you? I mean, I think the stereotype, perhaps, of Israel is it's a place where people have strong opinions and argue yeah. about everything.
Well, yeah.
I don't know if that's an unfair or fair
well,
stereotype.
Well, oh, it's absolutely right. It's absolutely right. But what I found so moving in this story is how, in a way, Israelis bring their military experience into civilian life because you continue the arguments about the nature of the wars and what are the consequences, but they also bring their civilian life into their military service. Military Israel is very relaxed. We don't salute. You call your officers by their first name. It's very intimate, and so there's a very strong civilianization of Israeli military culture, and that was important for me in understanding how the schism played out. Because when you look at Israel today, for all of the animosity in Israeli society, we still have a certain break, that B-R-A-K-E, that keeps us from going over the abyss. And I think it's the military, it's the intimacy of our military service. The fact that left-wing and right-wing leaders knew each other, knew each other's families, were friends. Some of the closest friendships that this book tells cross the left-right divide.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Yossi Klein Halevi is our guest. The book is called Like Dreamers, the story of the Israeli paratroopers who reunited Jerusalem and divided a nation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Live Nation supports WHYY. Alternative rockers Arcade Fire return to the Wells Fargo Center March 17th in support of their new album, Reflector. Tickets available today at 11 a.m. at ComcastTix.com, the Wells Fargo Center box office, or 800-298-4200.
Do you recall the first time you met John Kennedy?
Yes, I do.
I told him, I said, Mr. Kennedy, he says, look, my name is Jack. You call me Jack.
And there he was, in prison of the United States, standing on the doorstep.
I'm Robert McNeil, and the program is We Knew JFK, unheard stories from the Kennedy Archives, from the Public Radio Exchange.
God, I hope they don't play this for a long, long time.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now...
Here is a special bulletin from Dallas, Texas. 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas, Texas.
We'll mark the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK with your memories and more. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, a neighborhood grocery store offering super spinach salad, creamy Toscano cheese, or chunky guacamole with Greek yogurt. Store locations at TraderJoe's.com. Trader Joe's proudly supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. And if you're just joining us, Yossi Klein-Halevi, our guest, author of a new book called Like Dreamers. He's a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, a contributing editor of the New Republic, was born here in the States and has lived in Israel for about 30 years now. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I want to quote something you wrote pretty recently, actually, in the LA Times just a couple of weeks ago. You say, centrist Israelis are gripped by two opposing fears. The first is that there will be no Palestinian state and the occupation will become a permanent part of Israeli life. The second is that there will be a Palestinian state and the chaos of the Middle East will penetrate Israel's borders. You also describe yourself as a centrist.
Yes.
Is that where you stand or where you sit?
Very much so.
Very divided self?
Very much so. And that is a conclusion that most Israelis today have reached. We've internalized the left-right split so that it's not happening out there between two rival camps, but happening within each of us. And there are days when I wake up and it is a left-wing day. And I said, we just
because
get
what
out.
The sun is shining or it's raining or something happened overnight?
Or it's raining and storming. And I just say, we just have to get out.
Right.
And just cut it. And whatever dangers we'll face, we'll figure out how to
get
deal
out of
with
the
that.
West Bank.
Get out of the West Bank, and then there are other days when it's a right wing day, and I say, are you out of your mind? Look at the region. Look, one failed state after another imploding on Israel's borders. How can we take a chance of creating what very well might be one more failed state? But this one, 5 or 10 minutes away from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And that's an argument that Israelis are having with themselves now. And I think it's a much healthier argument because what's happened is we have finally begun to internalize the insights and the warnings of the two rival ideological camps.
But what's the solution to that dilemma? Because it's a dilemma in conflict with itself.
It is. So I think that the danger of a centrist position, and I'm very aware of this in myself, is it can very easily turn that internal stalemate into complacency. Where you say, well, okay.
Or paralysis.
Well, okay, you know, I'm in favor of a two-state solution, but I'm not going to do anything to implement it. So the first thing I think that Israel must do is a settlement freeze. I think that is so obviously a prerequisite. Simply not tamper with the situation on the ground so that if and when a time comes when we will be able to negotiate a safe withdrawal, we're not going to have to dismantle even more settlements than we have to today. And Gaza really is the precedent here. Israel withdrew in 2005 and uprooted all the settlements from Gaza. And we did that unilaterally. We didn't wait for a negotiating partner because we didn't believe there was one.
Mm.
And that, for me, is a prototype for what might be Israel's last-ditch fallback position. If we find that we can't negotiate an end to this conflict, we may well have to act unilaterally to save Israel as a democratic and Jewish state.
But Benjamin Netanyahu recently essentially gave a green light for more settlements in the West Bank.
Yes, and this is the great failure of his government. And Netanyahu did have a settlement freeze 3 years ago, a 9-month settlement freeze. And he felt at the time, with some justification, that he didn't get the backing and the support from the administration.
This administration?
From the Obama administration. I think the Obama administration made a big mistake in not embracing Netanyahu in a bear hug at that point. And saying, okay, this is a very important step. The leader of the Likud, the party of settlement building, has declared the most far-reaching freeze that any Israeli prime minister had ever imposed, including from the left. And that didn't happen. I think the administration, in fact, I know the administration afterwards realized that it had made a mistake in not embracing Netanyahu and in not pressuring the Arab world to reciprocate with some gesture to the Israeli public that would convince Israelis that there really is a possibility for peace. But having said that, I think that we can't let ourselves off the hook. This is a policy that we're imposing on ourselves, and it's a disaster for us. It's a disaster for Israel's reputation internationally. It just complicates what I think we're going to eventually have to do anyway, which is repeat the withdrawal from Gaza and the West Bank. I think that's clear to most of us.
But do you think there is a negotiating partner in the West Bank the way there wasn't with Abu Mazen?
I think that Abu Mazen wants to make a deal. I don't think he can. If you look at the constellation of Palestinian politics today, a friend of mine, a Palestinian journalist, put it ironically. He said, we've reached the two-state solution, a Palestinian state in the West Bank and a Palestinian state in Gaza, because they're really two separate and rival authorities. So in a way, the negotiations that are happening now with the Palestinian Authority are a mirage, because there is no unified Palestinian leadership capable of making the reciprocal concessions that the Israeli public needs to see from a Palestinian leadership that will signal to the Israeli public that their legitimacy in the Middle East is being affirmed. And for Israelis, this is not about peace, it's about legitimacy. It's about winning the recognition by the Arab world that the Jewish people is an indigenous people returning home and not a colonialist Western implant. And that's the message that we need to hear from the Arab world, and we have not yet heard it.
Do you think the occupation of the West Bank and the settlements, though, has hurt Israel among American Jews who living in this country, but they look over there
and
they object to this?
Unquestionably. And that is a position that Israel needs to hear. But I think we need to make a distinction between peace and settlements. And by that I mean that the settlement building is not going to be the make or break aspect of a peace agreement. We've proven in Gaza that when we have the will, we will withdraw and we will uproot our fellow citizens from their homes and dismantle settlements. It will be much more complicated on the West Bank. There are many more settlers.
It's a bigger piece of property.
Although not really that big. We live in a very intimate geography. But the real problem is the deep emotional, historical attachment that many Israelis feel toward what is the heart of the land of Israel. And I feel that too as an Israeli. The problem, of course, is that you have two peoples that each of which emotionally and historically can make a compelling claim based on its own narrative, its own self-understanding, for why the totality of this little piece of land from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea belongs exclusively to them. And we have one of two choices. We can either keep killing each other, or we can figure out a way of dividing it. But what I think that the international community needs to understand is that peace in the Middle East, if and when it happens, will not be a celebration, but a shared tragedy between Israelis and Palestinians. A shared tragedy because each side will have to give up part of the land that it loves and that it claims. Israel is going to have to cut it one of its limbs, and the Palestinians are going to have to do the same. And when Palestinians tell me that Haifa and Jaffa, which are part of the state of Israel, belong to them, my response is, you're right. From your point of view, it does belong to you. The problem is that Hebron in the West Bank, from my point of view, belongs to me. And we have two peoples that are fighting over the same little tortured piece of land. And the only solution is for each side to impose on itself an act of historic injustice and to deprive itself of the totality of the land.
Let me pick up on that, but let me first reintroduce you. That's Yossi Klein Halevi, author of a new book. It's called Like Dreamers, and it's subtitled The Story of the Israeli Paratroopers Who Reunited Jerusalem. This was back in 1967, and Divided a Nation. He's senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, a contributing editor of The New Republic. And any questions or comments, you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I mean, this would be a question to any country and to any leadership, which was how do you, in a sense, sort of give up something that is so dear to you with the hope that the future will be better?
Well, it's a trade-off, and the question is there hope that the future will be better? What makes the negotiations today between Israelis and Palestinians virtually impossible is that neither side at this point sees real hope. From an Israeli perspective, creating a Palestinian state now is such an enormous risk, especially given what's happening in the region. And yet I think that a majority of Israelis would take that risk if we heard Palestinian leaders say, we accept Israel as a legitimate part of the Middle East. We accept the right of the Jewish people to be a sovereign majority in one part of this land, and we are going to share this land.
And you haven't heard that?
We have not heard that.
In using those kinds of words?
Yes, because this ultimately is a conflict over intangibles. The tangible issues that we all know about are an outgrowth of the intangibles of legitimacy, fear, existential threat. Those are the intangibles that diplomats don't have the language for. And that's why I think a solution to this problem is so elusive. We need psychologists and theologians around the table.
Not politicians.
Or not just
politicians.
That's right.
You have Palestinian friends?
Yeah,
I mean, it's
sure.
A weird question to ask someone, and I realize this is a very intimate, as you say, intimate neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah, I do. Although the last years of violence in the region has made it increasingly hard to maintain those friendships. There are borders now, physical and invisible,
which are hard to penetrate or impossible.
Nearly impossible to penetrate.
One of the things, and I do want to get to some of our callers, one of the things that you wrote recently is that the fastest growing population sectors in Israel are the Arab citizens and the ultra-Orthodox Jews. And I'm assuming politically and many culturally, these are on sort of opposite sides with the centrists like you in the middle.
They are, and it's interesting because in the very delicate combination of Israel's identity as a Jewish state and a democratic state, the ultra-Orthodox community resonates with the Jewish part of the identity, not so much the democratic. The Arab-Israeli community resonates with the democratic, not the Jewish. And the centrist majority, now we're speaking not about the future of the West Bank, but the future of Israeli identity. The centrist majority wants to continue holding that Jewish and democratic identity and sees those components of Israel's being as non-negotiable. That's who Israel is. On the one hand, we are the continuity of the Jewish story. We have an organic relationship with Jews around the world in the same way that a Palestinian state, when it is created, will have an organic relationship with the Palestinian diaspora, those Palestinians who may choose not to go home. And so that's one element of Israel's identity, which is Israel. Right. And the other element is Israel as a democratic state. And if either of those elements were to disappear, I don't believe that Israel could survive in the long term.
Let me get some callers in. It looks like we have George from Vincenttown, New Jersey. And George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, thanks. I love listening to you.
Thanks.
I've got rather involved questions. I'll try and keep it short.
Yeah, keep it short. That would be great, George.
I'll do my part. The basically back in 1947, Israel just took the land from the Palestinians. Now they're saying, well, let's you and I negotiate. You will negotiate the you know, giving this back a two-state. And then the Oslo Accords, they were supposed to stop the settlements, but I guess it was Netanyahu who just said, oh, I changed my mind. We're not going to negotiate anymore. And I guess I'll take my answer off on the radio.
Okay, George. No, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
Well, George, you know, it depends where one begins to tell the narrative. In 1947, the UN voted for a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. And the Jews said yes, and the Arab world said no, and said it's all or nothing. And when you declare an all or nothing war, and in fact, the head of the Arab League at the time, Azam Pasha, said that the massacres of the Jews in Palestine will make the massacres of Genghis Khan pale in comparison. This was the head of the Arab League. So when one side says yes to a compromise solution, the other side says all or nothing and then loses, there are consequences in war. This is the only conflict in the 20th century that I can think of where the loser cries not fair after starting a war. Mm. And so that's one piece of it. In terms of Oslo, you're right that Netanyahu violated the spirit, if not the letter, of the Oslo process by continuing to build settlements. But you're also leaving out what I think is the most important part of the Oslo story, or two parts. One is that Yasser Arafat encouraged terrorism during the Oslo years as a way of trying to pressure or intimidate the Israeli public into more concessions. And in the year 2000, when President Clinton put on the table what became known as the Clinton proposals, December 2000, once again, Israel said yes, and this would have been another partition plan, which would have created a Palestinian state, would have redivided Jerusalem. Israel became the first country in history to voluntarily accept the redivision of its capital city. And Israel said yes to the Clinton proposals, and the Palestinian leadership said no. And once again, as in 1947, went to war, this time a four-year war of suicide bombings. Now, we live in the real world, not in abstract historical arguments. In the real world, those kinds of rejections and violent rejections have consequences.
George, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with our guest, Yossi Klein Halevi, author of a new book. It's called Like Dreamers, the story of the Israeli paratroopers who reunited Jerusalem and divided a nation. Again, a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, a contributing editor of the New Republic. He grew up here in the United States in Brooklyn and has been living in Israel for the last 30 years. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
What is The Pulse? Stories at the heart of health science and innovation. WHYY-FM's newest original program launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9. The critical issues and innovations as told by patients, doctors, researchers, and everyday people. Plus, an active and growing online multimedia destination at whyy.org/thepulse. The Pulse launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9 on WHYY-FM.
On the next Fresh Air, on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, we consider the Kennedy legacy with historian Robert Dalek. And we talk about what we know and don't know about his assassination with investigative reporter Philip Sheenan, whose book examines the Warren Commission's investigation of the assassination. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Murray. murder with a soundtrack.
To see a club full of people chanting these songs, parading around with fake bazookas, it just kind of blew my mind.
A new film, Narcocultura, from documentarian Shaul Schwartz, shows us the blood of the Mexican drug wars and the musical heartbeat of narcocorridos. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Yossi Klein-Halevi about his new book called Like Dreamers and hearing him share some of his perspectives on the challenges facing modern-day Israel. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Susan from Ridley Park to join us. Susan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have one question for your guest.
Sure.
What about the right of return to the Palestinian refugees? I'm a Palestinian refugee who was born in Jordan, now an American citizen. I have children who are born here in the U.S. How can he justify he is, as an American, he could go and live in Israel for the past 30 years, as you mentioned, but my children, every time when they go to visit family in the West Bank, they are interrogated at the Ben-Gurion airport, and sometimes they were asked to leave.
Mm. Susan, let me give our guests a chance to respond, and thanks for your call to Radio
Susan,
Times.
Thank you, Susan, for that and for that very painful comment mm-hmm. and question. My deepest hope is that there will be a two-state solution in which the Palestinian refugees will be able to go home to the state of Palestine, just as Jews are able to go home to the state of Israel. And the way that I understand the two-state solution, and I think it's really the only way that a two-state solution can work, is if we realize that there are two peoples, each of which is entitled to its own national sovereignty in part of the land that we share, and that each people is responsible for absorbing its diaspora or those parts of its diaspora that want to come home. Now, in the same way that my hope is that Palestinians, Americans of Palestinian extraction, if your children decide one day or their children that they want to go home to the independent state of Palestine, there will be a right of return that the Palestinian state will extend to anyone of Palestinian origin who wants to come home, whether they're from America or Argentina or Kuwait. Because that's a recognition that of a deep ancestral connection that your family and others have to Palestine. In the same way, the State of Israel recognizes that there is a Jewish diaspora, and many within the diaspora have opted to come home, whether from Ethiopia or from Morocco or from the United States. It doesn't matter where you come from. It matters where you feel you belong. And I believe that we have two peoples that whose right to sovereignty needs to be mutually respected.
Susan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Yossi, let me ask you about something you wrote about recently, and this was in response to a confrontation you had with a Jewish zealot. This was on a train.
Oh, in Jerusalem.
Yes, and it's titled A Troubling Tale of Jewish-Muslim Relations, and just to very briefly, an Arab was on this train with his, seems like a girlfriend or a female friend, and a Jewish woman. A Jewish woman, mm-hmm. And this, as you described, zealot, basically attack verbally and sounds
and
like almost physically attacked this person, and you intervened, yeah. And you were yelled at.
I was sprayed with mace. With mace, yeah.
by the Jewish zealot, yeah, as you describe.
Yeah.
You wrote, one unintended consequence of Zionism is that in creating a state that was not only Jewish but democratic, it placed necessary limits on Jewish solidarity. As an Israeli, I have a responsibility not only to my fellow Jews, but also to my fellow Israelis, whether or not they are Jewish, and I have a responsibility to those who live among us who don't have Israeli citizenship but are dependent on the fairness of the state's institutions. Sometimes those multiple levels of responsibility conflict.
Yes. Yes, Israel is a unique and uniquely complicated story. There's no example in history of a people that lost its land in ancient times and kept an active memory and kept faithful to its land and then managed to return. And that, for me, is one of the great stories of history, but it also has all kinds of very complicated consequences. Mm-hmm. And one of those consequences is that we need to realize that there's a difference between statehood and being a Jewish community in the diaspora. When you're a Jewish community abroad, and many Jews don't understand this, they haven't internalized the responsibilities of sovereignty. Hmm. Because when you're a minority abroad, then there's a natural level of both intimacy and responsibility, mutual responsibility, that makes sense when you're in an environment whose friendliness you're not always sure of. When you are the majority, that imposes responsibilities on you. We were not a majority for 2,000 years. We lost the memory. We kept the memory of the land, but we lost the memory of the experience of being in the land, which was a majority sovereign status. And that's what we're trying to reconstruct now in Israel, and doing so under enormous strain. And I think one of the great challenges for the Jewish people in our recovery of national power and sovereignty is that it happened under just unimaginable circumstances of moving in the 1940s, of moving from World War II into a situation that turned out to be permanent war and siege. And so there is a psychological imbalance in the Jewish people in terms of how do we react to threat? How do we react to the minorities among us? Are they a threat? Are they a moral responsibility? And how do you know? And that's partly what I see as one of Israel's great challenges.
Well, I do want to get back to our callers, but just picking up on that, I mean, it sounds like from your perspective, Israel is going through a period of introspection and thinking about its identity, its, as you have written, the role of the ultra-Orthodox, issues of income inequality, which, of course, we have in this country as well.
No, very much so. I think it's interesting to see how the implosion in the Arab world has impacted on the Israeli public. Because the tendency among many Israelis today is simply to turn inward. The region is so frightening, it's so out of control, that most Israelis have concluded there's really not very much we can do one way or another to influence the region. Let's finally start dealing with the long festering problems of our own society, whether it's income, the income gap. Israel in the 1950s and 60s and even 70s was the most egalitarian Western country in terms of income distribution. Today, it's one of the least.
Wow.
And there is a tremendous, longing among the younger generation of Israelis to recover something of the old social solidarity, which has been lost. So, and then the issue, of course, of the ultra-Orthodox. And this is the first government in over 30 years that does not have an ultra-Orthodox party represented. It's a very good moment in Israeli political history. And there are all kinds of laws that are being passed now by a much more pluralistic parliament that is intended to limit the powers of the ultra-Orthodox community.
Huh. Let me get to, it looks like Waleed from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Waleed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering what the guests thought about a binational solution, which is becoming increasingly popular amongst the Jewish and the Palestinian left. It's like you can see this in the writings of Judith Butler, Cornel West, Edward Said. Because there are Jews living in settlements in the West Bank and there are Palestinians living in Israel proper, how can we talk about a two-state solution when there are both populations are living amongst each other? What would happen to these settlements that are already built? Millions of dollars have been spent on these settlements. And this binational solution has been increasingly popular amongst the left. And I was wondering why that's not being discussed.
Fair enough. Waleed, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You'll see your response.
Yes, hi, Waleed. The First of all, in terms of the popularity of a binational solution in the Jewish left, you have to make a distinction between the mainstream Jewish left and what I would call the fringe Jewish left, or that part of the left that's outside the Jewish community. The mainstream left, say represented in this country by J Street, is deeply opposed to a binational solution, and I'll explain why in a moment. And it's really more the certain parts of the Jewish left that has really excluded itself from the Jewish community and the Jewish consensus that's championing a position which the overwhelming majority of Israeli Jews see as a recipe for disaster. I can't think of any conflict, any national or ethnic conflict that's been happily resolved in a binational context. You look at Lebanon, Yugoslavia, and I think that if we tried to create a binational state between Israelis and Palestinians who've been at war for decades, the result would be so disastrous that we would long for the current awful impasse. In terms of settlements and what would happen to settlements, there's an argument going on today in Israel whether it should be part of the Israeli negotiating position that settlers should be given the option of remaining in their homes and taking up Palestinian citizenship. In the same way that in Israel today we have over a million Arab or Palestinian citizens of Israel, there is that line of thinking that says that there should be Jews or Israelis who become Palestinian citizens. And my sense is some of the settlers would actually opt for that because their attachment is more deep to the land than to the state.
Oh, that's interesting. Waleed, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me ask you about, I was going to say how Israel views Obama, but I'm curious about how you view President Obama.
Well, you know, there was an argument during Obama's first term within Israel and also within the American Jewish community about, is President Obama a friend of Israel? And I always felt that was the wrong question. It's irrelevant if the President of the United States likes you or not. The question is, are his policies? And in terms of Obama as a friend of Israel, I think he, for most Israelis, he resolved that question in a very positive way during his trip to Israel last March, where he embraced Israel, he embraced the Zionist narrative, he affirmed the historical roots of the Jewish people in this land. He said all of the things that Israelis needed to hear, and Obama in turn was embraced by the Israeli public. So that a lot of the enmity that had existed, or suspicion, was really diffused. The situation today is that Israelis are now asking a different question, which is, will President Obama's policies in the Middle East result in a safer Middle East or a more dangerous Middle East?
Beyond Israel, you're saying?
Beyond Israel, and in which in the region that Israel has to find its place in. And here the overwhelming sense in Israel is that the president's policies in the Middle East are resulting in a much more dangerous place.
Well, let me pick up on two of them. One is, he did indeed draw a line in the sand about biological weapons in Syria, and looks like steps are being made to identify and get rid of these weapons. There is negotiation to try to figure out about Iran and its nuclear capabilities, with the idea of an interim period to try to resolve some of these issues. Does that not play well in Israel?
Well, let's look at the Iranian question. The negotiations with Iran put at risk, from an Israeli perspective, the two factors that are most challenging to the Iranian nuclear program. The first is the international sanctions effort, which the administration for its first 3 years was very reluctant to go along with. It was Congress that really forced the issue. And the Israeli fear, not only the Israeli fear, we saw the French adopt this position vigorously. And we know that large parts of the Arab Sunni world feel this way as well, and which is that if you start dismantling the sanctions, it will be next to impossible to reimpose it. It took years to put the sanctions effort into place, and starting to dismantle the sanctions would be rewarding Iran prematurely. And so that's one of the major concerns.
Well, and I'm only just because I'm looking at the clock here, and I hate to ask something with just a minute to go here, but is the other option a military option?
Yes, that is the other option. And Hegel recently said that the Israeli military, that the threat of an Israeli military option is largely what brought the Iranians to the table. And so the maintaining the credibility of a military threat is crucial for successful negotiations. Israelis desperately want a negotiated solution to this. It's our home front, which would be targeted by tens of thousands of missiles from Hezbollah, Hamas, Iran, if there is an Israeli military strike. But the fear of a nuclear Iran, which is shared by much of the Arab world, this is not only an Israeli obsession, that fear of a permanently transformed Middle East is in the end greater than our fear of the consequences of a strike.
Well, we could go on. The clock tells me we're out of time. Yossi Klein-Halevi, thank you very much for
joining us today
on Radio Times. And again, he's got the author of a new book called Like Dreamers, the story of the Israeli paratroopers who reunited Jerusalem and divided a nation. A senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, a contributing editor to the New Republic. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, podcast, archive, satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.